SBS Audio is supported by advertising.
SBS is Australia's most trusted multilingual broadcaster. Our listeners are loyal, highly engaged, and have supported countless local businesses. We offer advertising packages for businesses of all sizes. Our experienced sales team will guide you through the process of owning a great campaign. Bring your own ad or have our production team make you something in one of our 68 languages. Start the conversation with your new audience today. Email sales@sbs.com.au.
Hello.
You're on with Nick and Fiona.
It changes you in an irrevocable way.
Hi, you're listening to The Playlist. I'm Fiona Williams and I'm joined by my co-host, Nick Bassine. Hey, Nick.
Hello. Fiona, I'm really glad I came to work today because we are talking about exciting stuff. Wes Anderson's got a new movie, Isle of Dogs. I'm a big Wes Anderson fan. I was very excited about seeing the movie, like I am about seeing all of his movies generally. We're also talking to Michelle Law and Chloe Reeson, who created Homecoming Queens, a new show on SBS On Demand. And we're going to talk about what we've been watching, which is everyone's favorite part of the show.
But first, Isle of Dogs.
Yes. What did you think?
Well, I love dogs, which is
you're on the record,
a way of saying
on the record for being
no,
for
but
loving
it's a
dogs.
Play on that. It's a play on that.
Oh,
Isle of Dogs, right?
It is great. I love that.
Did that just dawn on you?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right.
I had no idea what was going on. I thought you were just saying I love dogs.
I mean, I do. As does Wes. As do some of the people.
Wait,
in this
did
movie.
Wes? This is going to make me sound not smart. Is that what he's doing with the title?
Yeah, it's a play on I Love Dogs. But it also is about an island on which there are dogs. So it is called Isle of Dogs.
Totally changes what I think about this movie.
Anyway, well, it was literally a throwaway line, but we've done 5 minutes on it. So Wes Anderson movies, yes, he's impossibly meticulous and twee. Lovely little caricatures of life. They're always beautiful. But here, he takes that fixation for beautiful things and the symmetry and whatnot, where it's usually so precise and perfect, and he sets it on an island of garbage where the cat-loving mayor of a large Japanese city has banished the dogs to the garbage island because he's a cat lover and you can't have dogs around.
Right. The dogs have a flu.
Well.
And that's the excuse he uses to,
quote unquote, dog flu.
Yeah, get rid of the dogs.
It's a public health and safety issue. Dogs are banned off to garbage island with them. And yet there's a plucky little teenager who just wants to go and find his dog spots. So he commandeers a solo plane to fly over to the Isle of Dogs to release the hounds and overthrow a corrupt leader and let the dogs out.
Yes.
Nobody's giving up around here, and don't you forget it, ever. You're Rex. You're King. You're Duke. You're Boss. I'm Chief. We're a pack of scary, indestructible alpha dogs.
Atari Kobayashi, you heroically hijacked a junior turboprop XJ-750.
Minute.
And flew it to the island because of your dog.
Darn it.
I've got a crush on you.
As I mentioned, I'm an enormous Wes Anderson fan, but I think of mainly Bottle Rocket and Rushmore, the first two movies.
Yeah, right. Okay.
I think those movies hold up so well, and they're two of my favorite movies of all time. I think they're both incredibly funny and different. And as Anderson's gone along, I think that he has indulged different parts of why he loves making movies. And the quirk is, like, it was evident in his first couple of movies, and then it kind of ramps up in Royal Tenenbaums, I think. And then he indulges it in different ways, and it can be heavier or lighter in different movies. And I think this, I liked it. I think it's nice, but I think this is heavy on the quirk. The stop motion animation, which he used in Fantastic Mr. Fox, there's so much detail everywhere. The faces of the humans, the every hair on the dog waves in the wind.
It is beautiful, very lustrous.
And it's very meticulous. There's so much attention to detail. The interstitial media moments with the TV and the radio.
And very gossipy dogs. There is a reference to the dogs being...
And that was very funny. Yeah, it was a good line. I mean, there's a lot of great voice talent in it. Jeff Goldblum, Bill Murray.
Bryan Cranston.
Liev Schreiber.
Scarlett Johansson.
And Tilda Swinton, who I think is the Oracle dog.
She's a little pug.
She's very funny.
Yes. And see, here's where I had pause before I saw the film.
Pause. I'm going to be just dog puns constantly.
Yeah, I actually didn't mean that one, but okay. With it being a Wes Anderson film with his usual collaborators, Bill Murray and Tilda, and set in Japan and speaking English. And, you know, I first saw the trailer, I thought, I'll wait and see, but in these uncertain times, everyone's hyper aware of who's telling whose story. But having seen the film, I think it deals with that quite well. And I think there is an explanation for why the dogs speak English.
The barks have been rendered into English.
Indeed.
Is the line. Yes.
Correct. Yes.
Like they're translating it for the English speaking audience.
Correct.
Right.
There are a lot of Japanese actors in the voice cast. That said, some of the Japanese isn't translated or subtitled. There are scenes where the Japanese population are speaking.
Yes.
And it's not. Translated or interpreted back for English-speaking audiences. But I think it's a movie moment where what they're saying is not necessarily crucial to the story, but it's observing daily life. And I don't know how I feel about that. And who am I to say what I feel anyway?
Well, it's meaningless.
It. Yeah.
I don't have a huge issue with it, but I think there is something in the idea, in the fact that you don't need to know what the Japanese people are saying. And that's why there's no subtitles.
I think there is an authentic reverence for Japanese culture that Wes Anderson is displaying here. And the references come thick and fast, and that he depicts Japanese life in the same way that he depicts American life in Royal Tenenbaums.
I agree with that. But that made me feel like this could be set anywhere. It made me feel a little bit like Japan is, and Japanese culture is just a backdrop. And I thought there's lots of familiar Japanese cultural references, but maybe these are the ones that everybody knows. The sushi, the drumming, the
poison
sumo,
wasabi.
Yeah, all haiku. Of that stuff. These are people, haiku, yeah. This is stuff we all know about Japan.
Yeah, yeah. And it is a bit of a greatest hits package of Japan.
But still, this was what made it so interesting. Like, I saw that, but also it's kind of tasteful. It's kind of nice.
Yes.
It's artistic and it's nice.
Yes.
Because he's not a raging bigot.
Not at all. I think it's done with the best of intentions, but it's a complicated one. I didn't come out thinking it wasn't the kind of film I feared it might be by any means. And the actor who voices the mayor, the cat-loving mayor, Kenichi Nomura, he is credited as a co-writer because he was brought in to check that it was authentic and for depictions of Japan and to, you know, and he gets a co-writing credit for that.
The one thing,
you know, which is to be credited, I think.
Yes. The one thing I think they should have changed just because it's a trope is the white savior.
Correct.
Not that it's anything is excusable or inexcusable, but if you know, if you've been around and you know what people are in tune to, that's a very obvious one that you can, that everyone's picking out. And
there
you
is a blonde American girl called Tracy who's an exchange student who sort of fires everyone up to back this attempt to get the dogs back. So she is seen sort of giving a battle cry kind of thing to a silent majority of Japanese people.
And that easily could have been just a Japanese girl. Yeah, why it didn't need to be an exchange student.
Yeah. So I think that is a weakness there, I do think. But yeah, so like it's a tricky one. You can't write off completely. And I think it's good to be talking about it. I think, you know, if you are conscious of how things are depicted and how other cultures are depicted, then I think that's a start. I enjoyed the film. I didn't think it was his best, but I, certainly came out thinking it was fun.
I agree that this is a conversation that needs to keep happening, and we keep having the conversation. But I didn't want to be so outraged about, you know, how dare he? And this isn't.
No,
it's not like, I don't think this is another Ghost in the Shell situation.
Yeah. It's certainly not a Matt Damon Great Wall. It's
no,
you know, and like all the language, all the credits are dual language.
Yes.
The poster is dual language. I think there's a real effort to do it right. I think there are a couple of shortcomings.
I read that the from Japanese speakers that some of the Japanese writing was kind of awkward, but it's a detail.
Yeah.
Part of the conversation. It got me thinking.
And I think you hold yourself up to that. If you are making a film about a culture that's not your own and you are relying on other, and it's certainly a language that you're not fluent in, you do hold yourself up to this kind of criticism. I think they anticipated a lot of that and were thoughtful in the way that they, by and large, did the story. You know, I think there are a couple of shortcomings there.
It got me thinking a lot about, I don't want to say Wes Anderson can't make a movie in Japan. That's not right.
No.
Like, that's crazy.
Yeah.
You can set your movie wherever you want. I think we have higher standards about the kind of authenticity and respect for wherever you're setting your movie. I think this might be a step forward as opposed to the Darjeeling Limited in 2007.
Yeah.
I would say there's a bit of Orientalism going on with the country as a backdrop.
Yeah.
And then a bunch of white dudes learn some lessons.
Yeah.
And then take off.
Being changed by the experience of being there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that was a weak film. That's probably low on the list of my Wes Anderson movies.
Yeah, close to the bottom for me, I would say. And it also got me thinking about something else someone said on this program, Kumail Nanjiani. Maybe you've heard of him.
Maybe I met him. I was that room too.
What we need is, because this is an American movie, but we need the Japanese-American person's version of this, mm-hmm. or their take, their vision. Like, I wouldn't tell Wes Anderson to not make any movie. He's fantastic. But I want to see what the Japanese person comes up with. You know, I'm not an expert on Japanese culture. And when I was digging around for, why is he doing this? Why is this set in Japan? Should he just set it in Texas and we don't have to have these conversations? But it's good to have the conversation. But just as a viewer, this is just how it feels to me. I'm not a Japanese expert. I didn't grow up in Japan. I don't speak the language. I've been there once and I've seen a bunch of Japanese movies. But even if you don't know anything, it can still feel a little weird. Or if it doesn't feel weird, it's still good to be in the conversation.
Yes, true. And I think the fact that it's obvious to the lengths he did go in order to be authentic and have a co-writer credited who is Japanese and was brought on to check that you were doing it well does help that. Because, I mean, you can sniff a terrible attempt at cultural appropriation a mile away.
And even if you're not Japanese, you can see that effort and you can appreciate it. You might not be able to spot Japanese Easter eggs, which apparently there really weren't any. But any of those aforementioned awkwardness of the Japanese writing or like you might not know that Megasaki's a made up.
Oh, I think you'd know.
I guess you could guess. I'm uncomfortable with the idea that unless you're Japanese, you don't have a right to qualify the movie. On that cultural appropriation basis.
I agree. But also I think there could be people in Japan who go, it's fine.
Yeah, it's great.
What are you worried about?
As long as the conversation's being had, there's nothing wrong with someone trying to make an homage that dances along appropriation for a country that he loves, a culture that he loves. I assume he loves it. It'd be weird if he didn't, I guess. I mean, I wish it had been a better movie, I guess.
Yeah.
But I wanted to ask you, because you're a dog lover.
Yes.
In the screening we were in, a lot of people were very taken with the cuteness of the dogs, and there was a lot of awe and a lot of, were you?
Yeah. They really got the behavior of dogs right. And just momentary little nods and looks and just dog behavior. And clearly it was made by dog lovers.
But it wasn't enough for you.
What do you mean? I thought it was good.
It didn't resonate.
Yeah, it was really sweet.
Were you
cute.
Emotionally invested? I grew up with dogs. Mm. I don't have one now. It's a lot of work. But
well, you have kids.
I was not emotionally invested at all in anybody's story.
Okay.
I didn't care if the kid found his dog. I didn't care
that's a problem.
If the nasty mayor got overthrown. Didn't really care about any of it.
What did you care about, Nick?
I wanted it to be funnier. I cared about the funny moments. I liked, because I think he can be so funny. Bottle Rocket and Rushmore just kill me constantly. And I'm not a white dude from Texas.
It's true.
As far as anybody knows.
All right. So that's Isle of Dogs. Yep. And that's now showing.
Homecoming Queens is a show that's just launched on SBS On Demand. And we were lucky enough to catch up with the creators, Michelle Law and Chloe Reason.
So Michelle Law plays a fictionalized version of herself, a children's TV presenter who returns home to Brisbane after an alopecia diagnosis, which shatters the facade of her perfect life. And she returns to see her high school friend, Chloe, who's recovering from breast cancer and is determined to make up for lost time with a reversed bucket list. And so now we're joined by the creators of Homecoming Queens, Michelle Law and Chloe Reason. Well, Michelle and Chloe, thank you so much for joining us on the playlist.
Thanks for having us.
So Homecoming Queens, for listeners who haven't had a chance to see it yet and don't know much about it, how would you describe it?
It is a show based on Michelle and I's real experiences, but fictionalized, about being diagnosed with chronic illness in your early 20s and the sort of loneliness that comes with that diagnosis, the sort of unexpected shock to the system that that is. And the show is basically about a friendship in the midst of that sort of lonely space and what changes about the friendship.
Yeah, so it's a 7-part web series and we like to describe it as a dramedy, so comedy with elements of drama or a drama with elements of comedy. And yeah, we're really looking forward to sharing it with everyone because it's been such a long time in the making that it feels surreal that it's finally coming out.
Sure. How long has it been in the making?
Like 3 years.
I think longer than that. I think maybe 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
How close is it to real life?
I think as soon as you create a character in any format, even one that's based on yourself, it takes on a life of its own. So at this point, when I watch the show, I'm like, this isn't us. But it is, but it still speaks very much to me of the experiences that inspired creating it. Yeah.
Yeah, I'd say it's very much fictionalized. Like, obviously, characters and events are inspired by our real life. But I suppose in any type of narrative form, you know, often fact is stranger than fiction. And sometimes strange things that have happened in real life don't necessarily fit into an episode or it's just a bit too bizarre. So we've had to sort of pick and choose along the way and flesh out whatever scenes or relationships made sense to the story.
And how long have you two been friends?
Well, this is actually kind of the big difference between our real-life friendship and the show is that in the show, Chloe and Michelle have been friends for a long time since high school. But in real life, we became we knew each other just from being writers in Brisbane and going to events. But it wasn't actually until I had been diagnosed with breast cancer and I was in hospital and Michelle and a mutual friend of ours came to visit me. And Michelle didn't have to do that at all. Like, we weren't close friends at that point, but it always meant very much to me that she came in that time and just sort of like Michelle and our friend James just sat with me while I was in hospital and we were making jokes about the hospital bed, like bed goes up, bed goes down. And then I think I was like crying at some points. It was like a whole...
It was a roller coaster.
It was a roller coaster of emotions, but it was, I think, very cool that Michelle came in that period. And I think it speaks to exactly what we're trying to do with this show is that there is this sort of bond between people who have had that shock that you can just sort of recognize something within between each other that is quite meaningful and powerful, I think.
I was about to ask what you wanted to achieve with the show and what you wanted people to get out of it. What might surprise them about this show?
I think me personally, every time we've sort of faced creative challenges or production challenges with this show, every time it's gotten tough, the thing that's gotten me through is knowing who will see it. And we really want to reach out to people who have chronic illness, especially young people living with chronic illness, because it can be such an isolating experience and you feel quite disconnected from other people your age, as well as, you know, even your parents or your family, because they might not be young themselves, but they feel like they can connect with you because perhaps they've had some chronic illness themselves. But it is an entirely very nuanced niche experience to be young but feel old. So definitely that's who I'm hoping to reach.
When you look at the TV landscape or even movie landscape, were there other things that inspired you or that where you thought there's nothing out there like this? We need to create something that fills this gap.
I think at the time there wasn't much.
Yeah, there wasn't much. And that was a big part of why we wanted to create the show is that although there are narratives, illness narratives out there, they're always, I think, about going from being sick to getting better. And that's illness and chronic illness certainly is never that simple. It sort of, it changes you in a irrevocable way that is, and it's quite a disorienting place to be in. So I think it was really important for us to fill that gap and to create a narrative that people who, even if it's not illness, even if it's just experiencing something in your life that changes you in a way that other people can't seem to understand, we're making a narrative for those people to feel sort of less alone in that space and time of their lives.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Michelle, you play a version of yourself. Chloe, you don't. can we talk about, I guess, playing a version of yourself but also casting someone to play a version of you?
Yeah. I guess playing a version of myself, it was quite strange and confronting at times because especially as we got towards the start of production, I had to put my writer's hat down and stop doing amendments and just be like, okay, what does the character want? Do a lot more character study and completely just shut off the writer side of my brain. It's been quite a fun process because I've gotten to play the really selfish and brash side of myself, which Michelle is a lot like in the show, and And I suppose it's been disassociating the real Michelle from that in my own head has been a bit of a challenge. But certainly I really enjoyed the experience, and I like that it sort of blurs the lines between fact and fiction. And I like that people sort of have to try and figure it out for themselves.
Sure. Having someone play me was a very interesting experience. We started writing the show, or at least talking about the show, I think less than 6 months out of me finishing chemo. So it's been quite wild for such a fraught experience to be shared with, Liv is a friend of mine now, but a stranger when we cast her, certainly. But I feel very privileged to have had Liv play me, because she does a really wonderful job. And there's moments where watching her play scenes that were heavily inspired by my real life, it's quite emotional in a really good way for me to see that happening and to sort of externalize those raw emotions that I remember feeling at that time. But I think also because we shot a version of the pilot before we ended up developing the series much further, and I think watching Liv play me in that time was actually good for me to be able to separate myself from the character, which I think maybe was something more difficult for Michelle, because it must have been weird because so much of the dialogue is based on our rapport. And so for Michelle, I think we discussed that you had to sort of like switch gears a little bit and work out how to play off.
Yeah, at some point I had to realize that Liv is not Chloe and that Liv has brought her own interpretation of the character, which is fantastic. But in my head, I sort of had to, you know, and through acting courses and classes as well, learn that, you know, I am projecting the Chloe that I know onto this character that I'm working with on screen.
So at no point you didn't have to just stop everything and say, I'm sorry, Chloe's not like that.
Liv, step back in line.
No, we were quite happy for Liv to have her own interpretation of things and to sort of take control of the character in the way that she wanted it to be. So
I think it makes the dynamic between them richer as well, because writing the show that was so much based on very intense experiences for both of us, I think it was important to have another voice in the room or another interpretation come in. It just sort of
removes you a bit.
Yeah, and gives greater depth, I think, to their relationship.
Why a web series? Why not a short film? Or, I mean, obviously we are happy to have the web series. It's delightful. It's wonderful. SBS On Demand. But yeah, just curious about the format, and are you huge fans of other web series?
Yeah, we were. And we always talked about the intimacy between watching things online. It's a really sort of ripe space for telling untold narratives, because you have that really just physically the distance between the person watching it and their computer or their tablet or anything like that. It's closer, and so you can really dive into those sort of very intimate narratives.
That's really interesting, because there's a lot of conversation about people watching movies on their phones and what a bummer that is, because you're supposed to, to be in a theater. But it can be
if you write for that space, it's actually exciting. There's so many things you can do with it if you just sort of like lean into that a little bit.
Right.
Yeah, I think it's a lot less inhibiting as well. And just from a creative standpoint, we were already quite big fans of other web series like High Maintenance and Broad City and shows like that. And I think creatively speaking, I really love the challenge of having constraints, and I like the fact that web series are quite short and snappy, and you need to learn how to restructure a story in a way that lends itself to that form, and it's quite digestible and binge-worthy, whereas when you're watching a show on TV, you know, you sort of feel like you're not allowed to leave, whereas you can sort of come and go with web series.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we're a movies and TV culture podcast, so we'd like to ask our guests what they've been watching lately, sort of what's loving or hating. It's always good to get something that you haven't particularly loved, but yeah, what have you been watching lately that's been on your radar?
I have been watching nonstop Chinese Dating with the Parents on SBS On Demand because it's incredible. It's champagne television.
We didn't tell her to say that.
No. I just love that show because I love If You Are the One. And then when I saw ads for that, I lost my mind. And I just really love, I guess because being Asian Australian, it's that feeling of what would my life be if my parents had stayed in Hong Kong or China. And it's just a completely other world to me. But at the same time, I do understand it. And I've just started watching, on a totally different tangent, The Crown on Netflix.
Same show.
Same show, essentially. Yeah.
Do you get pressure from your parents with dating?
More when I was younger, not so much now. I remember growing up on the Sunshine Coast and it being quite monocultural and me being like, I will never date an Asian person because they're all my family that I know of. And this doesn't make sense to me. And now my boyfriend's an Asian Australian guy.
Oh, wow. Yeah. All came back around.
Really did.
Fantastic.
And what have you been watching, Chloe?
My favorite show forever and always is RuPaul's Drag Race. Well, Trixie and Katya is on Viceland.
Yes.
Right. We were not told. We were not briefed beforehand about this.
I just love it so much. And season 10 is already incredible. I think more and more as the show's evolved, it's become more political and they're having, especially The Untucked, which is the companion show, like backstage, they're having the most insightful conversations about identity politics, which I love it. I like that my like kind of dumb, silly show has suddenly become like really fascinating. And yeah.
Do you feel like you have to be on the whole journey or can you step in?
No, you can come in at any point.
Okay.
I started with season 6 and then I jumped around a lot. I think when season 6 came out, I mean to say. But season 9 is the best season so far.
All right.
Yeah. And I've also been watching The Good Fight.
Ah, yeah. Okay.
Jesus, you people watch anything but SBS?
They watch it. They make shows for it.
Wow. Yeah.
And are you going to work together again? You sort of writing anything else?
We don't have plans to work together at the moment.
Yeah, nothing right now. We're sort of still wrapping our heads around the end of Homecoming Queens.
Sure.
Yeah.
But who knows what the future will hold.
Yeah. Wow.
Cool. Look, thank you so much. It's been a real treat to meet you both. And
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
So you can catch Homecoming Queens at SBS On Demand now, where all episodes have dropped. And we know what our SBS super fans, Michelle and Chloe, have been watching.
Super fans is right. We have to emphasize they were not coached.
No, they didn't even know we were going to ask that question.
Yeah. Very impressed.
I know. So that's what they've been watching. What have you been watching?
Well, I'm going to do just a quick one. Just a quick one this week.
Oh.
I happened to watch Shaun of the Dead, which is the Edgar Wright movie starring Simon Pegg and Nick Frost. There are a couple of English losers and a zombie apocalypse breaks out. It holds up very, very well with a couple of weird references and a couple of lines and jokes that you wouldn't get away with now. But other than that, very funny. I enjoyed it.
Excellent.
That's about it. That's all I got to say. It's funny.
You said it was a quick one.
Yeah.
Well, in keeping with, maybe not your one, but in keeping with the general theme of watching SBS content, shall we say, this week, I have been binge watching The Handmaid's Tale in anticipation of the second series coming
in a couple of weeks.
Imminently. Yeah. Yes.
Are you haunted all over again?
Yeah. It's very good, isn't it?
It is a good show.
Yeah.
What are you noticing the second time around that you didn't notice, may not have noticed first time?
Well, I'm not focusing on the plot as much this time.
Just how beautiful it is.
Oh, I mean, it is pretty gorgeous.
Very well
and speaking
shot.
Of Wes Anderson, sort of the symmetry
yes,
of the aerial shots
of symmetry,
the handmaids in their rows, their formulations. I do love the wry asides of Elizabeth Moss's narration. And some of the sexy times. Midway through the series with the driver. No spoiler.
Oh, yeah.
Well, if you haven't seen it by now, the first series is all up there for streaming as we wait for series 2 to drop at the end of April.
Now that you're almost done with the first season again, what are you looking forward to about the second season or what are you anticipating? Questions do you have?
I am curious to see where they're going to take the second series, especially as we're off the novel now. And
this is all new stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, Margaret Atwood is involved, so it's...
And there are some details that have been left out of the first series that are going to be introduced.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
So they say. So I'm just absolutely on the journey. Want to see where it goes. Loving it.
So that's it for the show. We want to thank Michelle Law and Chloe Reeson for coming in. We want to thank our producer, Jeremy Wilmot, whose dazzling work can be found at jeremywilmot.com.au. Make sure you get on to whichever platform you get your podcast from and subscribe to the playlist. Leave us a friendly review. You can say hello on email if you like, film@sbs.com.au, or you can follow us on Twitter or Facebook @SBS Movies. I've been Nick Bassine.
and I still am Fiona Williams. And you can find me on Twitter at anything but Fifi, if you're so inclined.
I'm at Nick Bassine.
Thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Why do people want to be at work? To feel heard, appreciated, part of something, and to know there's a career path for everyone. Inclusive workplaces are linked to increased innovation, productivity, and employee satisfaction. Make your organization a place where people want to be. For inclusion and diversity training, visit inclusion-program.com.au.